who let this half-blind stray near my harpsichord. Look at these cracked, filthy hands. Get away from my instrument!
Arrogant Duke pushed poor janitor off the harpsichord. Dirty hands. He was the blind secret musician for the king. Who let this half-blind stray near my harpsichord? Look at these cracked, filthy hands reeking of ash and lye. Get away from my instrument, you common dog. 400 aristocrats watched in silence as Duke Alexander Clark seized the old janitor by the collar and threw him across the marble floor like discarded rubbish. The bench clattered. A walking cane skidded across the stone. And the Duke stood over the fallen man, pointing a gold-ringed finger downward, his contempt absolute. The old janitor said nothing, but what no one in that ballroom knew, not the Duke, not a single lord, not the Duchess, pressing her trembling hands to her face, was the secret this broken, half-blind old man had been hiding for decades. A secret so powerful that when it finally came out that night, it did not just silence the room. It destroyed everything the Duke had built. This is where the story truly begins. Welcome to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles. If you're ready for more stories where the unexpected happens, where the forgotten rise, and where the underdogs turn the game around, hit that subscribe button right now. You don't want to miss what's coming next. Drop a comment below. Let me know where you're watching from and what's on your mind. Don't forget to like, share, and hit that notification bell so you never miss a moment of the drama, the revenge, and the secrets waiting to be uncovered. Welcome to the family. Now let's dive in. The cold arrived before the light did. It crept through the thin gaps in the wooden shutters of Ethan Christie's servants' quarters, settling into the stone floor, climbing the legs of the narrow cot, and pressing itself against the old man's bones with the quiet persistence of something that had been doing this for a very long time. Ethan did not fight it. He simply opened his one good eye, let it find the pale gray seam of morning light pushing through the shutter's edge, and lay still for a moment, the way a man does when he has learned that stillness costs nothing, and rushing costs everything. The room was small enough that a man with both arms stretched wide could nearly touch opposing walls. A single wooden stool, a wash basin, with a hairline crack running down its left side, a hook on the wall holding his spare tunic, and on the narrow ledge beside the cot's head, carefully positioned so that it would catch whatever light the morning offered, a folded length of silver ribbon. Ethan sat up slowly, the joints in his knees registering their familiar complaints. He reached for the ribbon before he reached for anything else. His rough, calloused fingers found it without searching, they always did, and he held it loosely in his palm for a moment, neither squeezing nor releasing, just holding. The ribbon had belonged to Rebecca. She had worn it threaded through her dark hair on their wedding morning, and on every significant morning that followed for 31 years, until the morning stopped. That was 11 years ago. The ribbon had lost its original sheen, softened by handling into something closer to cloth than silk, and Ethan had memorized the precise weight of it, the way a musician memorizes a rest, not by what it contained, but by what surrounded it. He set it down with care. The washbasin water was cold enough to sharpen thought, and Ethan used it with deliberate efficiency, face, neck, hands scrubbed to the wrist. He dried himself on the rough linen square hanging from the basin's rim, and then dressed with a precision that had nothing to do with vanity and everything to do with discipline. The patched linen tunic went on first, each patch a different shade of cream and brown, assembled over years of careful mending. He smoothed the fabric down the front with both palms, working out every fold, straightening the collar with two fingers. The dark breeches followed, worn thin at the knee but clean. The leather shoes, cracked at the toe but resoled twice, laced tightly and evenly. He stood in the center of the small room and, without a mirror, he had not owned a mirror in 9 years, made himself presentable by the standard of a man who believed that dignity was not dependent on an audience. By 5:30, Ethan Christie was already moving through the service corridor with his broom. The Clark estate in full daylight was a particular kind of grand, the sort that had been accumulated over generations, and displayed with the aggressive confidence of those who had never needed to question whether they deserved it. The main corridors ran long and pale, floored in white marble shot through with gray veining. The walls hung with painted ancestors and gilded mirrors that reflected the light of tall windows overlooking manicured grounds. It was, by any reasonable measure, a magnificent house, and Ethan had swept every inch of it so many times that he no longer saw the magnificence. He saw the corners, where grit collected. He saw the join between the marble and the skirting where dust gathered in a thin gray line each morning without fail. He saw the work. He moved without noise. That was not strategy. It was simply how he had always moved in spaces that did not belong to him. The lords who occasionally passed through the corridor in the late morning, already dressed for the evening's gala, looked through him the way people look through glass. Not with cruelty, precisely. With something that required even less effort than cruelty, a complete absence of registration. A young lord in a rust-colored coat swept past so close that his sleeve nearly caught the broom handle, and he did not so much as adjust his stride. Ethan stepped aside. The lord's conversation continued uninterrupted. The clouded left eye drew occasional glances from guests who had not visited the estate before. A misted, opalescent film had settled over the iris years ago, and in certain light it caught a faint bluish sheen, which had the effect of making strangers momentarily uncertain of what they were looking at. Those who noticed it looked quickly away. Ethan had grown so accustomed to this particular sequence, the glance, the slight recoil, the deliberate looking elsewhere, that he no longer registered it as anything worth noting. It was simply the pattern. He was working his way along the east corridor, the heaviest of the wash buckets stationed at the corridor's midpoint, when Douglas appeared at the far end, carrying his own mop, and moving with the particular unhurried efficiency of a man who had decided long ago that the work would get done whether he rushed or not. Douglas Fairweather was perhaps 30 years, Ethan's junior, broad across the shoulders, with a steady, undemonstrative manner that Ethan had come to rely on, the way one relies on a well-made tool, not with sentiment, but with quiet gratitude for its consistent function. Without a word, Douglas crossed to the heavy bucket and took its handle, shifting it to the next position along the corridor. Ethan did not thank him. Douglas did not wait to be thanked. This was their arrangement, and it had required no negotiation. They worked in companionable quiet for a time before Douglas spoke, keeping his voice low and level. He told Ethan to stay clear of the grand ballroom that evening. The Duke, he said, was wound tight as a watch spring about the gala the new harpsichord had arrived only the previous day, and the hired maestro was already reported to be delayed on the northern road. The house had been running on the Duke's temper since breakfast, and the servants on the upper floors had already absorbed 2 separate eruptions before noon. Douglas did not phrase any of this as instruction. He simply laid the information out, the way a careful man lays down a map before a known difficult road. Ethan nodded once, swept a long, slow stroke along the skirting, and said nothing. There had been a time, distant now, belonging to a version of himself he sometimes had difficulty fully believing had existed, when Ethan Christie had never swept a floor in his life. He had been 23 when the summons arrived. Not a public invitation. There were no public invitations for what the King's private musical council required. The message came through a single intermediary, delivered verbally and leaving no written record, and it communicated one thing with precise clarity. The King wished to hear him play, not in a concert hall, not before an audience of society, in private, behind a heavy velvet curtain that separated the performer from the court, so that the music existed in the room as pure sound, anonymous, sourceless, belonging to no particular man, and therefore belonging entirely to everyone present. Ethan had played behind that curtain for 11 years. He had composed pieces that high counselors wept to without knowing the name of the man who had written them. He had been paid handsomely, housed discreetly, and kept in a comfortable and absolute obscurity that suited him perfectly. He had Rebecca. He had the music. He had needed nothing else. Then the sight in his left eye began to cloud. It happened slowly at first, a faint haziness at the peripheral edge, easily attributed to fatigue, to candlelight, to age arriving ahead of schedule. But the cloud thickened through the months with relentless patience, and within 2 years the left eye was gone entirely, sealed behind its opalescent film. The court physician had named the affliction with clinical precision and offered no remedy. Ethan had said nothing to the court, had continued playing behind his curtain, the right eye compensating with a sharpness that seemed to intensify in direct proportion to what the left had surrendered. The music did not suffer. If anything, it deepened. But then Rebecca became ill. She declined across 8 months slowly at first, then with a terrible speed that left Ethan feeling as though the world was moving faster than he could follow. She died on a Tuesday in early spring, on a morning when the light through their window was, by some particular cruelty of the season, extraordinarily beautiful. Ethan sat beside her until the afternoon, holding her hand, and when he finally stood and walked to the window, something in him had closed that never fully reopened. He left the court 6 weeks later. No ceremony, no farewell. He told the intermediary only that he was done, and he walked away from the curtain and the music and the discreet comfort and the careful anonymity and found a different kind of invisibility, one that required no silk screen, only a broom and a willingness to be looked through. He had not touched a harpsichord since. Duke Alexander Clark arrived at his estate at precisely 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which was to say he arrived in the way that men of his particular disposition always arrived loudly, and with the clear expectation that the world would reorganize itself accordingly. His carriage was lacquered black, with the Clark crest embossed in gold on both doors. He descended from it wearing a deep royal blue velvet frock coat, trimmed with gold embroidery at the cuffs and lapels that caught the late afternoon light with an almost aggressive insistence. The powdered wig was freshly styled. The shoes, black leather with broad gold buckles, struck the gravel drive with the decisive rhythm of a man who considered hesitation a moral failing. Behind him, 2 steps precisely, came Jessica Clark. She was a handsome woman of 40. Fair-haired and composed in the particular way of someone who had spent many years mastering the discipline of composure. Her rose-pink silk gown was impeccable, her hair arranged in an elaborate construction that must have taken her lady's maid the better part of an hour. She moved with grace and said nothing. The 2 steps behind her husband were not accidental. They had been arrived at through a quiet negotiation of years. A negotiation in which Jessica had learned that maintaining a measured distance was the most reliable way of avoiding the edge of his attention when his mood was running sharp. His mood that afternoon was running very sharp indeed. He swept through the entrance hall, issuing instructions to 4 different members of staff in the space of 3 minutes, his voice carrying the clipped precision of a man who found it genuinely difficult to understand why things required saying more than once. The flowers at the hall entrance were repositioned. A footman was sent back upstairs to change his stockings, which had been deemed insufficiently white for the evening's company. A silver tray bearing a decanter and 2 glasses, arranged with perfect symmetry on the hall table, was declared incorrectly positioned and moved 2 inches to the left. It was in the grand reception room, however, that Duke Alexander found his finest grievance of the afternoon. A young serving boy, perhaps 14, slight and anxious, new to the estate within the last month, was carrying a tray of polished silver candlestick holders toward the ballroom when the Duke's gaze fell upon it. There was, on the underside rim of 1 candlestick, a smudge, a single smudge, barely visible, the kind that the most fastidious eye might catch in direct light. The Duke's eye caught it immediately. What followed was not a reprimand in any proportionate sense of the word. It was a performance conducted at considerable volume, with a small audience of 2 senior servants and a visiting lord who had arrived early, all of whom arranged their expressions into careful neutrality. The boy stood rigid, the tray shaking slightly in his hands, his eyes fixed on the middle distance with the look of someone concentrating very hard on not displaying what they were feeling. The Duke turned to his assembled listeners at the conclusion, gesturing broadly. Common minds produced common work, he informed them. The poor were constitutionally incapable of precision, because precision required a quality of thought that poverty, by its very nature, prevented. Dirty hands and dim wits, that was the inheritance of the lower orders, and no amount of instruction would alter what had been fixed at birth. He spoke with the comfortable authority of a man who had never once been required to test this theory against evidence. At the far end of the adjoining corridor, half obscured by the angle of the doorway, Ethan Christie stood with his broom held still, his one clear eye fixed on the shaking tray in the boy's hands. He watched the boy's jaw tighten, watched him hold it together. Then Ethan turned back to his work and resumed sweeping with the same unhurried stroke as before. He did not look back. He had heard speeches of that kind many times, in many rooms, delivered by many men who confused the accident of their birth with the evidence of their worth. They had not broken him then. He swept the length of the corridor in silence, turned at the window end, and came back. Outside, the afternoon light was already beginning to soften toward the golden hour. In the ballroom, the newly acquired harpsichord sat waiting on its raised stage, its gold-leaf casing catching the last of the daylight through the tall windows, gleaming like something that did not yet know what the evening would ask of it. Somewhere on the northern road, a carriage wheel had just thrown itself into the mud, and the evening had not yet begun. If you have ever been looked through, spoken over, or made to feel that the life you have quietly carried was somehow worth less than the coat on another man's back, then you already know exactly how Ethan Christie felt in that corridor. Stay with this story. And before we go any further, if you are not yet part of this family, hit subscribe to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles right now. Also, drop a comment telling me what you think about the story so far. It takes 10 seconds, and it means more than you know. The best part of this story hasn't even started yet. The storm arrived without much warning. It had been building through the afternoon in the way that late autumn storms build in that part of the country, quietly at first, a darkening at the horizon's edge, a shift in the wind's direction that the estate's older servants noticed, and the guests did not. By the time the first carriages began arriving at the Clark estate's torch-lit entrance, the sky to the north had turned the color of bruised iron, and the wind was pulling at the ladies' coiffures with an impertinence that no amount of pinning could fully restrain. The messenger arrived at 7:30. He came on horseback through the rear gate, soaked through to the skin, his horse blowing hard from the ride. The letter he carried was addressed to the Duke's head steward, Aldous Pemberton, a lean, careful man of 50, who read it twice before folding it with the controlled expression of someone calculating, very rapidly, exactly how much trouble he was about to deliver. The maestro's carriage had lost a wheel on the northern road, 2 miles past the Greythorn crossing. The axle was broken clean through. There would be no repair before morning. The maestro sent his profound regrets and his hope that the Duke would understand the circumstances were entirely beyond his governance. Aldous Pemberton understood, with the quiet certainty of long experience, that the Duke would understand nothing of the sort. He delivered the news in the private antechamber off the main hall, where Duke Alexander was receiving a small cluster of his most important guests before the formal opening of the ballroom. The Duke's expression did not erupt immediately. It tightened a slow, controlled compression around the jaw and eyes that those who knew him well recognized as the more dangerous register. He said nothing for a full 4 seconds. Then he excused himself from his guests with a smile so thin it barely qualified as one, and turned to Aldous with a very quiet voice that carried a very great deal of pressure inside it. He wanted the situation resolved. He did not particularly care how. Aldous bowed and withdrew to resolve a situation that had no resolution available to him. The ballroom at full capacity was a remarkable spectacle. 240 candles burned across 6 chandeliers, suspended from the painted ceiling, filling the room with a warm, amber-gold light that softened every face and set every jewel glittering. The women's gowns, silk and taffeta in rose, ivory, sage, and deep burgundy, moved through the crowd like slow, colorful water. The men stood in their dark coats and powdered wigs, wine glasses in hand, conducting the particular kind of conversation that people conduct when they are performing the act of enjoying themselves, rather than simply doing it. The harpsichord occupied a raised stage at the ballroom's north end. It was, by any honest assessment, a stunning object. The casing was finished in gold leaf applied over a warm chestnut base, the lid propped open to reveal the intricate paintwork on its interior panel, a pastoral scene of considerable delicacy, with figures amongst trees rendered in fine brushwork. The keys were clean and waiting. The instrument's tuner had attended to it that afternoon, and the last note he had sounded a clean, resonant F major chord had dissipated hours ago, leaving only the memory of itself in the room's acoustics. The stage was empty. The murmuring began at 8:30, when it became apparent to the assembled company that the musical program was not going to commence as scheduled. It spread through the crowd in the particular way that social discomfort spreads at gatherings of this kind, in low, discreet waves, behind raised hands and tilted heads, accompanied by the specific quality of glance that passes between people when they are jointly witnessing something going wrong and are deciding collectively whether to acknowledge it. Duke Alexander moved through his guests with rigid sociability, his smile performing its duties without the participation of the rest of his face. Ethan was not supposed to be in the ballroom. He had been stationed in the East Service Corridor for the duration of the evening, assigned the task of keeping the approach to the withdrawing room clear of the light debris that a large gathering inevitably deposited, dropped gloves, discarded programs, the occasional wine glass left on a windowsill by a guest who had moved on and forgotten it. It was quiet work, and it kept him sufficiently removed from the main event to satisfy Douglas's warning. What drew him was not intention. It was sound. The tuner, in his final pass across the harpsichord strings that afternoon, had left one string fractionally over-tensioned, and as the ballroom warmed with the heat of candlelight and gathered bodies, the string expanded with it. At 8:43, without anyone touching the instrument, it released a single, sustained tone into the air, barely audible beneath the crowd's murmur, but audible, a faint, clear, lonely note hanging in the warm air like something waiting to be answered. Ethan stopped walking. His right eye turned toward the doorway at the ballroom's far end, without his having made a decision to turn it. The candlelight from inside caught the gold-leaf casing of the harpsichord across the room, and the reflected light reached him in the doorway, a warm, concentrated gleam that struck his eye with a familiarity so sudden and so physical that he felt it somewhere behind his sternum before he felt it anywhere else. He stood in the doorway for perhaps 30 seconds. Then his feet carried him forward. He moved along the ballroom's outer edge, staying close to the wall, threading between the backs of guests who did not look at him. His eyes were fixed on the instrument. The crowd thinned near the raised stage, the area immediately before it left clear, in anticipation of an audience that had not yet formed. He reached the stage steps, 3 shallow risers, and climbed them without pausing. He sat on the bench. His rough hands rested in his lap for a moment. Then he reached forward and touched the keys. He did not press them. He simply laid his fingertips along the surface of the keys with the gentleness of a man reacquainting himself with something he had been afraid to miss. The voice came from his left, at considerable volume. "Who let this half-blind stray near my harpsichord?" Duke Alexander crossed the ballroom floor at speed, and the crowd parted before him with the instinctive reflex of people clearing the path of something moving too fast to stop. He reached the stage in seconds, and what he did next took perhaps 2 seconds to complete a hard, two-handed shove at the old man's collar and shoulder that sent Ethan off the bench and across the stage floor. The walking cane that had been resting against the instrument, clattering down the stage steps and skidding across the marble below. Ethan struck the stone floor of the stage with his hip and elbow and lay still for a moment. The ballroom had gone completely quiet. 400 people stood without speaking. The candles burned on, indifferent. Duke Alexander straightened his coat. He looked down at Ethan with an expression of genuine, untroubled contempt, the expression of a man who felt entirely comfortable in this moment and saw no reason not to be. He reached into his waistcoat pocket and withdrew a single coin. He held it out over the edge of the stage and released it. It struck the marble with a sharp, ringing note and spun twice before settling. The Duke told the assembled company loudly, with the easy fluency of a man performing for an audience. He was certain was on his side, that the beggar wished to entertain them. He gestured broadly at Ethan, still on the floor, and invited him to show the room what a half-blind stray could produce. Give them something to laugh about. The evening had been lacking in amusement. Several of the men nearest him produced thin, obedient smiles, the kind of smiles that have nothing to do with amusement. Ethan Christie lay on the stage floor and looked up at the painted ceiling cherubs and pale clouds in the candlelight and was quiet for a long moment. Then he pressed his palm flat against the stone and pushed himself upright. His hip ached where it had struck the floor. His elbow was bleeding slightly below the sleeve. He stood, straightened his patched tunic with both hands, and turned back to the bench. He sat down. His fingers found the keys, and for a terrible, suspended moment, nothing happened. Then his hands moved, and what came out was not music. It was a stumble. His fingers, stiff from years of brooms and buckets, from cold mornings and hard labor, from 11 years of deliberate silence, slipped across the keys and produced a jarring, discordant cluster of notes that rang out across the silent ballroom, like something breaking, a harsh, wrong sound, graceless, amateurish. The Duke's laughter arrived first, followed by the dutiful laughter of his nearest companions, short, sharp, the kind of laughter designed to land like a blow. Several ladies exchanged glances. A lord near the back murmured something to his companion and did not bother to lower his voice. Ethan sat still, his hands rested on his knees, and his right eye was fixed on the middle distance, looking at nothing, looking at something no one else in that room could see. He was hearing Rebecca's voice, not as a memory softened by time and sentiment, but clearly, the way voices sound when they have been carried inside a person for so long that they become indistinguishable from one's own thought. She had told him once, early in their marriage, before the gray had come into his hair and the cloud into his eye, that the first note was never the music. The first note was only the door. What mattered was what came after. He lifted his hands and placed them back on the keys. What came after was not a performance. It was a reckoning. It began in the middle register, a slow, deliberate passage of extraordinary clarity. Each note placed with the precision of a man who had not forgotten a single thing he had ever learned, only set it aside, the way a letter is set aside until the right moment to open it arrives. The sound filled the lower half of the room first, settling into the space between the marble floor and the guests' feet, and then it rose naturally, without forcing, the way a fire rises when it has finally found sufficient air. The laughter stopped within 4 bars. By the 8th bar, 3 of the ladies nearest the stage had turned fully to face it. By the 16th, the crowd had begun a slow, involuntary movement toward the stage, the way a crowd moves toward warmth when the cold is sufficient. Duke Alexander stood to the side, his expression cycling through several phases in quick succession, none of them comfortable. Then Ethan shifted into the composition he had written for Rebecca. He had written it the summer after their first year of marriage. On an afternoon when she had fallen asleep in the garden with a book open on her chest, and the light had fallen across her in a particular way that he had wanted desperately to preserve, and had no painter's skill to do it with. So he had done it in the only language he truly owned. He had given the melody her quality unhurried, warm, possessed of a quiet intelligence that revealed itself gradually rather than all at once. He had never performed it for the king's court. He had never performed it for anyone. It had existed only between the two of them, played in the evenings in their private rooms, her expression when she heard it, the only audience it had ever needed. He played it now for 400 strangers, and they received it the way strangers sometimes receive a grief that is not theirs, with a recognition that preceded understanding, a sudden, involuntary sense of having lost something they could not name. The ladies were weeping first, then the gentlemen, though several of them managed it with sufficient discretion to maintain appearances. The chandeliers trembled faintly as the bass notes built through the final passage. And when Ethan lifted his hands from the keys for the last time, and the final chord dissolved into silence, the room remained quiet for 3 full seconds before it rose to its feet. All of it. Every lord and lady, every titled guest, every powdered wig in the room, standing, the applause filling the ballroom with a sound that shook the candle flames in their holders. Duke Alexander Clark did not stand. He was still standing apart, rigid and pale, when a voice cut through the applause from the crowd's center. The man who stepped forward was perhaps 60, silver-haired, wearing a dark embroidered coat of considerable quality, his bearing carrying the particular weight of someone accustomed to being listened to when he spoke. Lord Aldrich Montrose, royal advisor, intimate of the king's private council for 20 years, had been standing at the back of the crowd since the first notes of the second passage, growing increasingly still as the music moved through its progression. By the closing movement, he had been certain. The profile, the left eye, the particular way the hands moved in the upper octaves. He had stood in a darkened anteroom a very long time ago and heard those same hands do the same thing, and he had never forgotten it. He addressed the room. His voice was measured, clear, and carried the absolute authority of a man delivering a fact rather than an opinion. He told them who Ethan Christie was. He told them about the silk curtain and the king's private council and the 11 years of anonymous performance that had moved the most powerful men in the kingdom to tears they never spoke of publicly. He told them that the man presently sitting at Duke Alexander Clark's gold-leaf harpsichord in a patched linen tunic was the most celebrated undisclosed musician in the history of the royal court. A man whose name, the king, himself had ordered kept from all public record, out of respect for his terms. The ballroom received this information in total silence. Then every head in the room turned toward Duke Alexander. He opened his mouth. He produced the beginning of something, an explanation, a justification, the scaffolding of an apology that might preserve some portion of what the evening had cost him. He spoke about being unaware, about having known nothing of the old man's standing. Had he known, naturally, he would have. Ethan turned his face toward the Duke. His right eye found him with a calm, level precision that had nothing in it of anger and everything in it of absolute clarity. When he spoke, his voice was quiet enough that the nearest guests leaned slightly forward to hear it. He told the Duke that he had not needed to know who Ethan was. He had only needed to know who he himself was. The silence that followed was the most complete the room had produced all evening. Jessica Clark, who had stood 2 steps behind her husband throughout the entire night, took 1 deliberate step to the left, then another. Then she turned, and the gap she left between herself and Duke Alexander was wide enough and precise enough that every person in the room understood it for exactly what it was. 2 footmen appeared at Ethan's side, sent, Lord Aldrich Montrose informed the room, by standing instruction from the king's household, extended to Ethan Christie wherever he was found. A royal carriage waited at the estate's front entrance. Ethan stood from the bench slowly. He smoothed his patched tunic with both palms, the same gesture he had made at 5 o'clock that morning in his cold, small room. Then he walked down the 3 shallow stage steps and through the crowd, which parted quietly before him and did not look back. Duke Alexander Clark stood alone beside his golden harpsichord, in his magnificent coat, in his magnificent house, surrounded by 400 people, and had never in his life been so entirely by himself. There is a man in this story who spent 11 years being looked through, spoken past, and made to feel that the life he quietly carried was worth considerably less than the coin thrown at his feet. He never stopped ironing his uniform. He never stopped holding that ribbon. If any part of this story reached you tonight, if you felt that injustice, and then felt that music, then you are exactly where you belong. Subscribe to Forbidden Secret Love Chronicles right now. Drop a comment and tell me where in the world you are watching from. Share this story with someone who needs to hear it, like it, and ring that notification bell, because the next story is already waiting. And it will not be kind to the undeserving either.